This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode number 822. Thank you so much for joining me here today as we dive in and talk a little bit about something you rarely hear on our show, and that is apartment syndication. You're going to hear a great rags-to-riches story, if you will, as the old saying goes, and I think you'll like it. And also, I am happy to announce something very rare. Yes, very rare. We have had zillions, well, maybe not exactly zillions, but quite a few, at least, quite a few people and companies approach us over the years and ask to sponsor the show. And we have said no to quite a few of them because we didn't think they were a fit with our message. But we do think this company is a fit, and that is Renters Warehouse. I had the pleasure of speaking on a panel last year with their founder, and we met in Phoenix with a bunch of their team members last year. Never quite got a working relationship off the ground. They were working on some of their technology and expanding into some other markets, and we were just busy doing other things. But we're really looking forward to working with this company. It's called Renters Warehouse. They're an award-winning property management company. They're servicing over 13,000 investors nationwide. They are a Morningstar rated property manager. They deliver unmatched service and transparency. They have a centralized model and a local staff in several markets that provides trustworthy support across many markets. Now, they are not in every single market that we're in or every single market we've been in, but they are in many of the major markets. So, for example, if you own a property in, say, Chicago and you live in New York or California or Washington State or wherever, you can feel rest assured that they're going to take good care of your Chicago property or a property in any of the other markets. They track all aspects of your property, and they never try to profit on maintenance or repairs. Plus, you enjoy a flat pricing model and tenants that are warranted up to 18 months. So go check out renterswarehouse.com/Jason. That's renterswarehouse.com/Jason for a special offer and learn more about them. We're really excited about working with them and happy to have them as a sponsor for the show. And maybe in the near future, we'll have them on the podcast to talk about things in more detail. Okay, so the market is hot. And listen, I know a lot of you get discouraged. I totally understand, because you go out and you pick out properties and then, boom, they're gone. I know the feeling. It's tough. It's tough out there. But look, that means that properties are obviously in high demand, and they're in high demand for a reason. That's because so many people in the market think the deals are good. Now, there is a distinction here. Of course, you know, I talk about this frequently, how you must subdivide. You must divide markets up into three categories: linear, cyclical, and hybrid markets. And so I'm going to play a short CNBC video clip for you here in a moment. And this is in a cyclical market, as you can tell. Those markets are even crazier. Look at, I spent the vast majority of my real estate career in the cyclical markets in Irvine, California, Newport Beach, California, Tustin, South Orange County, Mission Viejo, Aliso Viejo, Laguna Niguel, all of those areas, Foothill Ranch, Ladera Ranch. I sold many, many properties. And then I owned a real estate company after I was a regular agent that sold many, many properties in those markets. And of course, you know, about 12 years ago, I sold that company to Coldwell Banker. And that was the impetus for me getting into this business, becoming a financial services firm for real estate investors, because I just found that when you wanted to be a nationwide investor, when you wanted to invest in the most historically proven asset class in all the world, it was pretty hard to do on your own. At least for me, it was pretty hard to do on my own. And so basically, I got into this business and created a whole company and a staff and a team and a process and a business model around this business so that I could be my own first customer. And that's exactly what I was. I was the first customer of my own business. So that is kind of interesting how big discoveries come out of needs. What do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention, right? Is that the saying? Necessity is the mother of invention. So that's why I started this business, and it has been a great ride, and we thank all of you for your support over so many years and so many thousands of transactions and so many properties that you've purchased. So we really appreciate that, and we will continue to do whatever we can to be a vital part of your wealth building team as we help you build nationwide real estate portfolios in those good, conservative linear markets, and maybe from time to time we'll get off into a hybrid market, but probably not these crazy cyclical markets. So my point being here, if you think it's difficult to get a property in Indianapolis or in Memphis or in Little Rock or in wherever or in Oklahoma City or any of these markets or Jackson, Mississippi or any of these markets that you see at jasonhartman.com in the properties section, well, it would be even worse and even more crazy if you were in some of the cyclical markets trying to buy a home. And you know what? Don't buy a home in those markets. Rent your mansion. It's a much, much better deal. It really is amazing. By the way, well, let me play this little video clip for you here. And I can't quite get it to queue up and start right at the beginning. So what Diana Olick with CNBC says when she starts is she says, the market is red hot. Properties are flying off the shelves. And here I am just going to play this the low-tech way right off my computer, and we will listen. It's only a minute and 20 seconds.
Especially at the entry level, as millennials finally start to move into their home buying years, and even the new spring listings are not enough, not even close. We went to a Sunday open house in Burbank, California yesterday. It already had three offers before the real estate agent even opened the door, and when he did, more than 100 people came through.
I've been selling real estate for 25 years, and this is the strongest seller's market I have ever seen in my entire real estate career.
The house was listed at $780,000, which is considered entry level in the LA area. It drew a lot of renters looking to buy but getting outbid. One young couple we spoke to had already lost out on another home.
So we actually bid over asking price, and yet it went way over asking price, I'm guessing, with waiving of contingencies being one of the things. So we could waive contingencies as much as we like the place.
And that's one of the biggest issues for first-time buyers. They don't have a lot of cash. They're mortgage-dependent, so they cannot waive the appraisal contingencies. And in most cases, homes today are not appraising as high as the sale price. That means buyers have to make up the difference in cash. And cash, my friends, is king in this market. Back to you.
Okay, so did you hear what Diana Olick with CNBC said about how buyers have to make up the difference in the appraisal price? And folks, I know that some of you listening are thinking, well, gosh, I had to do that too in, you know, one of the markets that you're buying in as an investor, not the crazy Burbank or Los Angeles market. And that is true. Sometimes you have to do it. Sometimes, though, that appraisal is saying maybe you shouldn't do it. And each situation has to be evaluated on an individual case-by-case basis because, again, real estate is a very fragmented business. We all know and we all understand that. Now, one little note I want to say on a separate matter. You know, we've talked a lot since the election, since the surprising win of Donald J. Trump, and we've talked about how I believe and I predict that will stimulate the economy dramatically. Well, many would argue that it already has, as Trump approaches his first 100 days in office. That has certainly happened, right? But today, in the news, you are seeing a lot of news about how Trump wants to reduce the corporate tax rate for owner-operated businesses. Now, I don't know exactly how they define that, but think about how insane, I mean, not insane from a bad way, but how insanely incredible and fantastic this would be for the economy if it happens. He wants to bring the tax rate from 35% down to 15%. 35% down to 15%. Now, who knows if this will ever happen, if it'll ever pass, if it'll ever be signed into law. I don't know. But look, folks, at least, love or hate Donald Trump, at least you've got someone who is a business person in the White House for the first time in a long, 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 long time. Okay? At least you've got that. And look at this. You know, think about how much, look at, if you are affected by this and you make $200,000 a year, for example, and you have an extra $40,000 a year to put into the economy, and you look at the multiplier effect on that, okay? You know, the government is really into this idea of fractional reserve banking between the government and the central banks. And this is the way all governments and all central banks essentially work at their core, okay? So our Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank, the ECB, or whatever, right? It's all the same concept. The U.S. can just get away with it better than anybody because the U.S. has the largest economy, the biggest brand, the world's reserve currency, and the biggest military the human race has ever known. So with that in mind, that's what they do, right? Money is lent into existence. We've talked about that many times before, how and it's very hard to get your head around this. Listen, it took me years to get my head around this. And really, I still don't have my head around it. But in many of the other episodes that we've done, or we've had Bill Bonner from Agora Financial, or Steve Forbes from Forbes Media and Forbes Magazine, or Chris Martinson from The Crash Course, or Lawrence Kutlikoff has been on a couple times, the very famous economist, and you know, Harry Dent, it doesn't matter, you know, whoever, right? Bob Prechter with the Elliott Wave Theory, or any of the other, you know, literally hundreds of thought leaders and economists that we've had talk about this subject on the show over the last 12, 13 years, right? They talk about the multiplier effect. And that is true, how when you borrow money, it creates new money. And I remember when I spent a day, and by the way, it's funny, this just came up on my Facebook memories, which I love that feature of the privacy invading Facebook company. That is a fantastic feature. So on Facebook memories, I spent a couple of days in Washington, D.C. with the National Real Estate Investors Association. And this was about 8 years ago. I was almost like new to Facebook back then. That's when I first started using it, I think. And, some of these pictures just came up the other day on my Facebook memories about how I was lobbying a congressman. You know, I remember I ran right into John Kerry in the hallway, you know, on Capitol Hill. And I spent a couple days there and we did this lobbying and it was really interesting. And I remember being in Arlen Specter's office. And his, one of his people, his assistants came out. And by the way, Nancy Pelosi, oh my gosh, she must have had the most luxurious office in the whole place. I mean, it was beyond ridiculous the way these, Nancy Pelosi was like the most abusive politician. Did you ever read the articles when Obama was president and Pelosi was flying around and, all of our taxpayer paid aircraft and just the bar bill, literally for the bar on the plane from, D.C. to San Francisco was like many, many thousands and thousands of dollars, all paid for by you and I. Yes, thank you very much. You and I paid for that. Totally abusive, disgusting. But anyway, the multiplier effect, that's our point here, right? It is that multiplier. And so I remember sitting in Arlen Specter's office, and one of his people sat with us, and she was very knowledgeable. But again, all part of the disgusting Keynesian, big government, disaster that, we have, right? This spoken from a libertarian perspective. And she said, look, we were talking about the bailouts, and then we were there to lobby for real estate investors and talk about seller financing and, hopefully get them to, not pass Dodd-Frank in the way they wanted to pass it. And I'm not sure what effect we really had because it's all too damn complicated. It gets lost in the shuffle. But she said the reason almost exactly this. She said the reason we didn't give the, between those three bailout programs, it was almost $3 trillion, right? The reason we didn't give the money to the people, you and I, the taxpayers, in the form of a rebate, and we gave it to the banks instead, is because it would have a multiplier effect. Well, what does that mean? That means that if the banks had taken that money and instead of paying those frickin' greedy criminals at Goldman Sachs and B of A and Wells Fargo, I'm the most disgusted with Wells Fargo right now, instead of them lining their own pockets, right, with that money, if they had really lent the money out as they should have, she was saying that the reason we gave the money to the banks instead of to the people is because it had a multiplier effect. And she's right. Even though philosophically I disagree with the whole concept of fractional reserve banking or fractional reserve lending, call it what you wish, but she is right. There's a multiplier. So what happens if the tax rate, look, under Trump, the tax rate is probably going to go down. I think we can bank on that. By how much and in which way and which type of tax, we don't exactly know, because that has to work its way through government and it's very difficult to do. But imagine if you earn $200,000 a year and you now pay $40,000 less in tax, right, because of that example that I just shared on the Trump tax proposal. If you pay $40,000 less in tax, what could you do with that money? Well, you could buy a nice new car every year, a brand new car. Okay, so what would that do? Well, it would enrich the car salesperson, the car dealership. Hopefully you don't buy a Tesla Model 3. I don't know. My Tesla Model X has been pretty dang bad. It's been a terrible experience. That Model S, the one I had before, it was okay. But this one, I am not happy with Tesla. Call me an unhappy customer. So don't buy a Tesla, okay, with that money. But imagine if you did that. Imagine if you improved your home or bought two more rental properties. Hey, with $40,000 extra, you could pretty much buy two kind of inexpensive rental properties. Maybe, you put in an extra 10 grand and you really could buy two nice rental properties. Imagine the effect the multiplier effect that has on the economy, the number of people that are involved in that real estate transaction, the people that fix up that property because you bought those two properties, you created more demand in the marketplace. And what did that do? Well, that caused some rehabber, a local market specialist, to go out and hunt for more properties. And how did he hunt for more properties? Well, he probably did a bunch of mailings. So some money went to the post office. That's probably not the best use, but anyway, it did. Some money went to the printer. He maybe hired some more people, or she, for that matter, hired some people. Then once they got a property, they bailed someone out of maybe a property they couldn't afford and helped them create more financial stability for themselves. And then what happened after that? Well, they had to hire a rehab crew, flooring people, painters, electrician, plumber, some different tradesmen to come through, landscaping people to come through and fix up the house and get it rent ready. And maybe they bought some window coverings and a whole bunch of money trickled through the system. Maybe they bought some new appliances. And then they paid someone to sell the property for them, to find them an investor. So maybe they paid our company. Maybe they paid a traditional realtor. Maybe they paid both. And then what happened? Well, that investor put the property up for rent. And then a tenant came in and rented it, and a credit report was run, and someone charged some money for that, and an application fee happened, and some money changed hands, and then the renter moved in. And then a property manager got one more property to manage for their account, and they made some money, and it goes on and on and on. Hey, this is the glory of capitalism, right? I don't have to explain this to any of you, unless you're a total left-winger, right? You get it. You understand how incredible the multiplier effect is. This is why Arthur Laffer and Ronald Reagan had, before the internet boom, the largest peacetime expansion of the economy ever in human history was under Reagan. Okay, now, after Reagan, you had Clinton come, terms later, right? And he actually beat Reagan, but there's a couple things you have to know. You got to, number one, adjust for inflation. That's the first thing you've got to do. And number two is you've got to adjust for the fax machine and the internet and the speed of commerce and the increase of commerce and the efficiency of commerce. And so that was what Clinton benefited from. But, you know, to Clinton's credit, even though I'm not a Clinton fan, in hindsight, as far as the economy goes, he actually doesn't look too bad because, you know, Clinton knew enough to kind of keep his hands off it. He was busy with his hands on Monica. Oh, bad joke, Jason. Don't say that. Okay. Anyway. So yeah, that's what you had. So this is trickle-down economics, right? It's supply-side economics. In essence, it's the multiplier. It's fractional reserve banking in a positive way. So, hey, let's keep an eye on what the Trump administration does here. But no matter what, I'll just bet you, taxes are going down. Maybe they're not going down by 20%, but they're going down. Okay, we are going to see a tax reduction and some better tax law under Trump, and that's going to be really, really good for all of us. Hey, let's get to our guest. Let's talk to Joe Fairless, a friend of mine and a good guy, and we'll learn a little bit about apartment syndication, his rags to riches story, and be sure to check out jasonhartman.com for properties, educational products, real estate software on the resources page, and we will talk to you on the next episode, which will be Flashback Friday, handpicked for you, coming up in just 2 days. All right, here's Joe. It's my pleasure to welcome back a returning guest, and that is Mr. Joe Fairless. I've been on his show a couple of times, and this is his second time on mine, and he has a phenomenal story about his success and his startup as an apartment syndicator, and so let's just dive into that. I want to talk about this. He's controlling now $130 million worth of real estate in Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, and Cincinnati, and all through syndicating multifamily properties. Joe, welcome back. How are are you?
Thanks a lot, Jason. I'm doing well. Nice to be on the show.
Yeah. It's good to have you back. So you started just not too long ago. Give us an idea as to your startup story. First of all, what attracted you to real estate?
I was in advertising, working at an advertising agency in New York City. And I'm originally from Texas, but moved straight from New York City to Texas. From Texas to New York City.
The other way around. Yeah. That's what I thought.
And I was making $30,000 a year as a junior project manager. So clearly...
Well, Joe, $30,000 in New York City goes a long way,
rolling,
right?
Yeah, I was rolling in the dough. Rolling in the
dough. You were a baller.
Yeah, exactly. And so clearly I didn't have any money to invest in real estate or save. But as I progressed, I was able to save money and I ended up becoming the youngest vice president of a New York City advertising agency. My salary was like $150,000 plus bonus. So as I progressed, I was able to save money and I needed to figure out what was I going to do, because one of the things I did while I was working in advertising living in New York is I got made fun of by my friends a whole bunch. And the reason why is because I stayed in my apartment for 9 years. Even though all my friends around me were upgrading their apartments, living alone. I had a roommate from Craigslist. I had like 7 different roommates from Craigslist over those 9 years. And I had a dorm style refrigerator, no living room. But my rent was the same and it was low relative to living in New York. So I was able to save more money than most people would be able to with the money I was bringing in. And I bought my first place in 2009.
Okay, so before you go on, I want to ask you about that first place. But folks, this is what I always talk about. Being willing to delay gratification, that is the sign of foresight and intelligence and self-discipline that will ultimately bring you success in life. You know, there are people who spend money and squander their money on the appearances of wealth, or there are other people like Joe, our guest today, who actually saved his money to buy the things that create wealth rather than give the appearance of wealth. Joe, all of your friends were doing the appearance of wealth thing. That's the common path. But you did not take that path. You lived way below your means, and certainly $150,000 plus bonus at an ad agency is still not rolling in it in New York City, because I know how expensive it is to live there. So what was your first property?
It was a 4-bedroom, 2-bath house. Might be 2.5 bath, but 4-bed, 2-bath-ish house. Bought for $76,000 down payment all in. I was at around $20,000 because I had to put 20 where in Duncanville, Texas, which is 15 minutes south of Dallas.
Okay. And so that was 2009. All right.
That was 2009. In hindsight, a very, very good time to be buying in Dallas.
No question.
2009. And by the way, before I bought that house, I lost my earnest money. About $1,000, because I messed up, my real estate agent messed up. I don't exactly remember what we messed up on, but clearly it was not paying attention to the contract. And that was a big hit. It still would, it wouldn't be a big hit for me now, but it still would, it would burn a little bit if I lost earnest money, $1,000, $2,000 on something. And that happened and it delayed me. So I was ready to buy in January, but I didn't actually close on something until October. So it took me 10 very, very long months to find the property and then to actually close on it. And then I went from one single family house in 2009, bought another a year later, another a year later, another a year later, ended up getting 4 single family homes. The fourth one was not good. It was more of a fixer-upper. I was living in New York City. It was in Fort Worth, Texas. And I didn't have the right team in place. I ended up probably about breaking even. I sold that home because it just didn't meet my model. But the 3 homes I still have today. But I realized quickly that, one, I was apathetic towards my advertising agency responsibilities. And two, I wasn't going to get rich off of buying these one-off single-family homes at the frequency in which I was buying them. Therefore, I decided that I need to look at either I need to do something different. So I went to a Rich Dad Poor Dad seminar, a 3-day seminar, and they taught me.
And let me guess, you met Ken McElroy.
No, I didn't meet Ken.
Okay. All right. But he's been on the show a couple times.
Okay, cool.
And spoke to our group before. Yeah.
although I think I have read one of his books, I ended up, as soon as I walked in, you know, my chest was puffed out. I thought I was very, very experienced real estate investor, when in reality, the first thing they said when I walked in is, you're not going to get rich on single family homes. Now, that's debatable, because I've interviewed people who have gotten rich off them, but they said,
well, you know, what does rich mean? That's
right,
all relative.
Exactly. It's relative.
So
right,
you got to define that.
So,
yeah.
So they said, do mobile homes or apartments. And I was not familiar with mobile homes, so I gravitated towards apartments. I was living in an apartment at the time, and I started studying apartments, and that got me into the apartment world. And simultaneously, I was, as I mentioned, I was apathetic towards my full-time job, and I eventually left the advertising industry. And that was in January of 2013. And now fast forward to what I've set 2017, and I've got 8 apartment communities, Houston, Dallas, and now we have one in Fort Worth, Texas, under contract, and over $130 million worth of apartments that my business partner and I have.
Okay, so your business partner and you got into syndicating apartment buildings. Now, how did you start that? I mean, like, what did you do first? Did you find a property and then go out to some people you knew and say, hey, you know, you want to throw in some money on this? Or did you first create a private placement memorandum and then find a deal? I mean, give us the insight into that.
Well, it's what I did and then what I should have done. So I'll tell you what I did. And then
that's fine.
And
yeah,
then I'll
that's
tell you what,
honest
I'll
answer.
Tell you what I should have done. What I did is I was looking for properties. Even though I didn't have the money lined up, I had some initial interest. And really what sparked my or what motivated me to press the gas is I was teaching a class in New York City while having my full-time job on how to invest in other markets where the numbers make sense, because I had a lot of my advertising friends say, what, you have a house, you have two homes, you have three houses, how are you able to do that? You work in advertising and these homes are not in the state. So I ended up teaching a class, and one of my oldest brother's friends, he heard that I was teaching this class. He's like, hey, can you just send me the PowerPoint? I want to take a look at it. I'm interested in getting the real estate. Well, he looked at it.
So what was the title of the class? Like, what was the class on?
How to become financially independent while keeping your full-time job.
Okay, and that was about single family homes or apartments?
That was about single family homes. I wasn't in the apartment world yet.
Okay, got it.
And I taught probably about 40 or 50 in-person classes with groups ranging from one of my friends to about 10 people. So they weren't big classes, but it was just something that I was doing on the side. And this gentleman, my brother's friend, his name's Kelly. Kelly said, hey, send me the info. He did. He said, this looks interesting, but if you ever do something larger, let me know. So I was like, wait a second. Okay, maybe I have a customer before I have a product, because I'm in the advertising industry. I know about marketing, and that is the best business model. When you have customers demanding stuff, and he wasn't demanding it, but just to make the point, when you have customers seeking something out, but you don't have enough product or you don't have the product. And that's what really motivated me. I was like, wait, I think I got something. So I even though he was on board, the properties I was looking at were much larger. And I thought, you know what, I'll just find the money if I find the property. And I eventually—
That's a leap of faith.
It is a leap of faith. And you know what, it eventually panned out. I did find the money from investors, and those investors I met through— I knew through my existing network, which was advertising. So it was advertising coworkers. I was a captain of a flag football team. So one guy who only knew me through playing flag football in New York, he invested. I had three roommates, two in college, one post college. They invested, and
So give us the numbers though. Like, how much was this first deal? What was it? And how much did they invest?
6.3. So it was a master lease. It's a little unique. 6.35 million. That was the purchase price when we exercised our option to purchase. The amount that was raised was $843,000, but the disclaimer or the asterisk is that I had the brokers put in their commission to get more of a down payment for the property. And it was like $317,500, I believe. And they got 25% of the deal, which is a little bit less, I believe. I think they got watered down a little bit in the total equity. And then we did a master lease with 168 units.
Okay, so now that begs the question, because people are asking, what is a master lease? So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Master lease, I'm sure listeners of, or they might have heard.
I know the concept,
but I know.
The listeners don't.
I get that. The listeners might have heard of a land contract. And it's similar to a land contract, but if you haven't heard of either one, I'll tell you what a master lease is. Master lease is basically leasing the property from the current owner and taking over all of the income. So you receive all the income, but guess what? You also have to pay all the expenses, including the debt service. And the objective, or the reason why you would do a master lease, is if there is a owner who has a property that they have a prepayment penalty on, or there's a yield maintenance or defeasance, basically they can't sell the property without having to pay a large fee to the lender, then this is an opportunity for them to exit the property and you to enter the property as the master through a master lease and take over operations. Now
because you get around a prepayment penalty, which big commercial loans often have those, and they are huge, by the way, you know, when you're talking big properties. And so you don't transfer title to the property, you just basically become the master tenant and have a bunch of the subtenants, just like if you were the owner, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
And you become, it's sort of a triple net concept too, in a way, because you basically become responsible for everything in the master lease, right?
Yeah, everything, absolutely.
Okay, yep. So what else do you want people to know about the master lease? Because that's an interesting, creative way. You know what I'd be curious about, Joe, is have you ever heard of a lender? You know, there's an old principle in the legal world, you know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck, you know, no matter what you call it, right? Have lenders ever tried to call that loan and say, pay us the prepayment penalty, I wonder, with a master lease?
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say earlier, is there are downsides to a master lease and things to watch out for. And one thing that I watched out for, thank goodness, prior to closing the master lease, is I read the loan documents.
A wise man.
Yeah, I actually delayed closing at least 2 weeks. Because after reading the loan documents, it stated something to the effect of, if you do something like a master lease, you better get the lender's approval. And I wasn't about to bring in, you know, my investors' money into a deal where that could have just been wiped away because the lender wants to take the property back, calls the note. So what we did is we notified the lender and we got written approval from the lender. So that's a great point that you mentioned, and that for anyone interested in doing a master lease knows, because I've interviewed people who do talk about master leases and the amazing benefits of it. Very rarely do they mention the due on sales clause or the lender going back to take it. Usually they say, oh, well, how would the lender know? Or they never do that. What they wouldn't do that if the property is performing. That's a lot of risk
with a large
apartment community. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can get by with that with a single family house worth $30,000. It's, you know, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Right. I would agree with you. And you know, Joe, I'm so glad you brought that up, because so many people, you know, we have clients that come to us with this stuff all the time. And I'm sure you have investors that come to you and it's like they saw the guy on late night cable TV. They went to a seminar and they all just massively oversimplify it. It's such a crime what some of these promoters out there do, you know, in just massively oversimplifying this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot involved. And you're also in a vulnerable position when you do the master lease because you don't own the property and the lender is going to be really focused on the person who's personally guaranteeing the loan, and that is the person you're doing the master lease with, if there is a personal guarantee. And so there's three parties involved, and when you do an exit or when you have a contract that has to be reviewed, let's say you're selling the property, then you're going to have three sets of attorneys that are needing to review and approve and agree upon everything. You're going to have the buying group's attorney, you're going to have your attorney, and you're also going to have the current owner's attorney. And so if you don't like lawyers, then
this is not your business.
This is not, yeah, well, this is not your business, but yeah. this type of approach, I mean, it might not work because there's a lot involved. So it is not a simple tactic. And holy cow, I looking back, why did I do it on my first deal? I don't know. It just made sense for that deal. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend it on your first deal because it is more advanced. Now, all of our future deals since then, I mean, I have 8 apartment communities. They have not been on master leases, nor would I do a master lease again because I think with the interest rates now, where they're at, who knows where they'll go, but where they're at, we're getting good financing and we approach it more traditionally. But that was just how I got in the game.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting stuff. Okay. How did you learn to syndicate though? Like, you know, and did you just go to an attorney and have them draft the private placement memorandum or, you know, what did you do? You know, there's sort of a lot there to know about things that, you know, did you sort of have another person's document that you used as your model or?
I had a consultant that I hired and I brought him on. In addition, I befriended a real estate investor who was doing syndication in New York City. And I happened to meet a developer who's based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I met him at a conference that I had gone to previously, and he helped me out and he shared documents and attorneys and contacts with me.
Good stuff. Okay, so that was the master lease deal. Now, did you dispose of that property yet or do you still own it? Or lease it, I should say.
Yeah, right, yeah. We sold that property and the next 8 properties that we bought. So I did that first one here. The interesting part is I did the first one on my own. And what I recognize, and this is how, because a lot of people wonder, you know, how did I scale so quickly? And I think that's, I imagine a lot of listeners want to know that too. And how I was able to scale so quickly was on the first deal, I did it all myself. I mean, sure, I had property management partners and lenders, et cetera, but I did it. I put together the PPM with an attorney. I put together, you know, the property management team, et cetera. When I realize is I have talent or I'm skilled in one or two things. I'm especially talented in maybe 1 to 2 things at most. And in other areas, I'm lacking the experience or I am not an expert in. And so what I did with deals number 2 through 8 was I partnered with my current business partner now, and we formed a company, Ashcroft Capital, and that has grown the business tremendously because my focus now is on raising money and making sure we have the equity for every deal. Versus his focus, he has a more traditional background where he did asset management for $500 million worth of apartments. He's been in the industry for 10 years doing multifamily for a larger company. And he does the asset management / underwriting, primary underwriting. And that's the key for anyone out there looking to scale their business. The key is to identify your special talent, know what you want to focus on, what you're good at, and that's helped us grow Ashcroft Capital to where it is today.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, good. Well, you know, maybe there's just something I haven't asked you that you want to share with the group, and you know, feel free. Just I'll let you have it.
For anyone who wants to do multifamily syndication, I'd say the first thing you want to do is know the foundational elements of the business. And I've got a free guide that I'm happy to give, apartment resources guide with a bunch of free resources and podcasts like Jason's on there. You can email info@joefairless.com, and it gives you all the bunch of free resources that helped me get up to speed when I was starting out. And you know, it'll help you too. Also, multifamilysyndication.com has a bunch of videos and content for people to take it to the next level to learn more about it.
Excellent. Well, that's fantastic. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today, and I just wish you continued success. You've really got an amazing story, and it just shows how real estate in any form, I mean, you can, you know, I always like to say you can make money in anything. There's not one answer. You know, I wouldn't be investing in retail right now, for example, because of the retail apocalypse we keep hearing and reading about. But certainly there are people who make money doing retail properties, right? I like housing. I like apartments, single family and mobile home parks. Those are my favorite. Self-storage probably being the fourth, although I've never owned a self-storage, but I've had mobile home. I have a mobile home park a couple of apartment complexes, and then a bunch of single family. But you know, you can make money in any form of this business, industrial properties, whatever. You've just got to specialize and focus and be very, very careful of the market and the overall situation out there. Anything you want to say to that before we sign off?
Nope, all good.
Okay. Hey, Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thanks.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.